Next case for argument this morning is In the Matter of Right. Mr. Wu.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Xiaoming Wu. I represent Craig LaShawn Wright, the appellant in this case. The facts of this case are simple and undisputed, and our position is very straightforward.
I wish one could say that the facts were all straightforward, but one critical fact, so far as I'm concerned, is what your client agreed to. That is, what's actually in the financing contract. And I tried to, I succeeded in finding the financing contract in the record, but it's totally illegible. Is there a legible copy of the contract someplace?
I'm sure there was, but it was probably not filed in the bankruptcy court. I assume that
the contract was filed in the bankruptcy court.
No,
it's part of the proof of claim.
I mean, a legible copy was probably not filed with the court, but I'm sure.
Do you think that you or Mr. Frankel can get us a legible copy of this contract?
I'm sure Mr. Frankel can.
Your client should have a copy of this contract, too.
He does, but we didn't think whatever the contract says is material to the issue.
I don't see how anything, basically anything other than the contract, can be material. The reason I ask this is that once you knock out Section 506, the remedies go back to those provided at state law. That's the holding of Butner. And state law basically means the Uniform Commercial Code, and we know from the Uniform Commercial Code what the creditor's rights and remedies are, except they can all be varied by contract. And so figuring out whether this contract varies the Uniform Commercial Code has got to be absolutely crucial to understanding this case.
Well, Your Honor, I think if you read Section 506 in isolation, it could mean that federal law is knocked out, state law applies. But I don't think the law should be read in isolation. As Supreme Court said, Congress...
I don't know about reading it in isolation. My reference was just to the Supreme Court's holding in Butner that when the Bankruptcy Code does not address a particular topic, we look to the rights and remedies under state law, and they're enforced in bankruptcy. And the Supreme Court's repeated that many times. So if you knock out Section 506, which otherwise would have told us how to handle the deficiency, then it seems to me Butner sends us to state law. And in order to apply state law, we need to figure out what's in the contract. That's the only point I'm making.
When Congress intends that the parties and the court should apply state law, they make it very clear in the statute.
Look, your brief and reply brief don't discuss Butner. Butner says that you don't refer to state law in the bankruptcy code. You don't have to. That it's just there in the background. When the bankruptcy code doesn't cover a subject, state law does. That's the holding of Butner. Now, if you have some response to Butner or some way of understanding Butner that's different from that, I would very much appreciate it if you would discuss it, because your brief is silent on that topic. But it seems to me very important.
We did not discuss that issue because that issue was not raised in...
No, it was the basis of the bankruptcy court's holding. The bankruptcy court said, knock out 506, you're left with state law. Well, that's Butner. That's the core of this case. Now, the bankruptcy judge may be wrong, but you have to discuss Butner and similar cases to show it. I don't see how you can ignore Butner and still make that point.
Well, our position is simply Congress, when amending the bankruptcy code, did not say state law applies, as in always.
You are articulating the position that Butner rejected, which is that the bankruptcy code, that state law applies only if the bankruptcy code explicitly refers to or adopts it. Butner held that that's not necessary, that state law applies unless the bankruptcy code says otherwise. The norm, the presumption, is state law. Now, maybe I'm misunderstanding Butner, but you can't respond to it by saying, well, the bankruptcy code doesn't refer to state law, because then we know from the holding of Butner that state law applies.
Well, traditionally, Congress always has referred to state law.
No, that you are reciting the position rejected in Butner.
I can give the court a very analogous example. In 1993, Supreme Court issued the ruling in Rake versus Wade, where the court held a mortgage lender is oversecured, the homeowner must pay back the arrears plus interest on the arrears.
Interpretation of Section 506.
Right.
And we know from the hanging paragraph that Section 506 does not apply. So we need to figure out what happens when Section 506 does not apply.
Right, and I guess I would say if it's your position that there is something positive that was enacted in the bankruptcy code in BAP-CIPA that replaces 506, if you will, then you need to point us to right.
that.
Because, of course, Congress is fully entitled, if it wants to put a different regime into place. And as I understand your position, Congress put an asymmetrical regime into place under which the creditor would be fully secured if there, of course, there's no cram down anymore, but the creditor's fully secured on the one side, but the debtor has the right to force the creditor to take effectively less for the debt if there's this full surrender. So, for example, if the amount of the debt's $18,000 or so, which it is here, and the value of the car has slipped to $12,000, your clients want the $12,000 surrender of the vehicle to wipe out the $18,000 debt. And the question is that the regime that Congress passed?
Well, that's what we're debating.
It would be strange to me in light of the bankruptcy, the 1995 statute, or sorry, the 2005 statute in general, the BAP-CIPA, to think that Congress did that. It would be quite out of keeping with most of the rest of that statute. Maybe they accidentally gave debtors a break in one part of it, but it seems
always possible.
Inconsistent.
It sometimes happens. That's a natural result of knocking out that 506 section.
Judge Wood's question was, did they enact anything? Right. We know 506 is gone. That's the result of the hanging paragraph. Is there anything that was affirmatively enacted that you're relying on?
To replace Section 506?
Right.
Anything.
Not to our knowledge. I think it boils down to what Section 506 does not apply means. I think most courts in the country interpret that to mean bifurcation, cram down, those are not permissible. I think another way of reading it...
They're not provided by federal law, and then we need to know what comes in its place, right? And we're back to my question, which is that normally one expects, see Butner, that state law comes in its place. That leaves us the Uniform Commercial Code and this illegible document. You may win under this illegible document. It would be nice to know.
And I would just add that even if you're relying on some implicit reading of the bankruptcy code, one of the things we often ask in bankruptcy interpretation is, what would the world have looked like had there been no bankruptcy? What would the rights, this is essentially a different way of phrasing Judge Easterbrook's state law question, had there been no bankruptcy, it's clear that the creditor has the right to collect the full amount of the debt that the people agreed to pay, unless there's something really unusual in that contract. So why is it that the bankruptcy somehow makes them able to avoid a certain part of that debt through this mechanism of exchanging the now depreciated collateral for the debt?
As I said, it boils down to what that hanging paragraph means when it says Section 506 does not apply. One way to read it is federal law doesn't apply, state law applies. That would be a major qualitative change apart from the history of the bankruptcy practice prior to 2005.
Is that there's some theory that under bankruptcy law that they ought to start with a clean slate? This is the only thing I can figure out in tracing this through, because if the property is retained in the state, then they could whatever value you get out of it, at least before 506 was taken out from under 506. Is it the idea that because the person is trying to get cleared out in bankruptcy, that the surrender is the full consideration that the creditor is going to get regardless of its value? I can't come up with anything else, because a large majority of the bankruptcy courts have followed your position, I think. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's correct.
And I guess I know the at least the psychology of bankruptcy is, well, let's give the debtor a fresh start. Is there something that got woven into did that rationale get woven into some of those opinions?
That's possible, but as far as I'm concerned, that would be somewhat speculative. I cannot read those judges' mind, but I cannot read.
But we got to read the law, I'm trying to figure out is how so many courts did that.
I think most bankruptcy courts in dealing with bankruptcy cases on a daily basis, they interpret the hanging paragraph narrowly to mean simply bifurcation cramp down cannot be permitted. I think if you read it to mean state law applies,
I'm lost.
That would be a qualitative change.
I don't see how any of this turns on the meaning of the hanging paragraph. The only thing the hanging paragraph says is 506 doesn't apply. We then need to figure out what happens when 506 doesn't apply. And that's not dictated by either 506 or the hanging paragraph. It's dictated by the rest of the bankruptcy code. And that's where, you know, my Butner question is coming from and where Judge Wood's question is coming from. Is there something else in the bankruptcy code that we should turn to with 506 gone? Some other language in the bankruptcy code that we should turn to?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. As I said, most bankruptcy courts just simply interpret 506 to hanging paragraph to mean you cannot bifurcate it. It doesn't. They don't go beyond that. I think courts make it clear if Congress intends a drastic change, basically throughout federal law, apply state law, and historically Congress has always made that clear. As I mentioned,
well, you're running into your rebuttal time, but it sounds to me like you're saying that they're reading this Section 506 shall not apply language to eliminate two of the possibilities, because 506 talks about bifurcation, and it doesn't quite talk about cram down, but it talks about bifurcation, and that's what leads to cram down, and it leaves surrender alone. I mean, that's what you have to be saying, I think, in a way. But if you want to save a minute for rebuttal, that would be fine with me, too.
Well, Congress does not, the hanging paragraph does not make any distinction between.
I know. It just says Section 506 shall not apply.
Which, to most courts, it means they are fully secured for all purposes.
But what does that mean? I mean, my problem with that is fully secured. Again, go back to my example of the debt that's $18,000 and the car that's now worth $12,000. Are you saying that the creditor now has a right to $6,000 worth of assets in the estate on a secured basis, even though they didn't have any perfected security interest in those other $6,000?
I think you can put it that way. Basically,
I mean, that would be the interesting.
The car would be the equivalent of this of $18,000.
But they already have their security interest in the $12,000. I mean, you're trying to make, you need something to make that mean something other than what it obviously means to begin with, which is that you've got your full security interest in the $12,000. Anyway.
I think you're trying to say fully secured equals the car regardless of its value.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can look at this car and pretend it to be a stack of cash of $18,000. If the debtor decides to keep the car, they pay $18,000. If the debtor decides to give it back, well, they get $18,000.
But they don't, of course.
What would happen outside of bankruptcy? After having the car for a year, your client drives back to the dealership and says, "Here's your car back. The debt is canceled." Is that what would happen?
No, that's not.
Why not?
Well, I can see the way the court is going, basically the state law applies in that case. But
because the car is depreciated, of course. I mean, that's why not. And if you've scraped some paint on it or something, maybe it's depreciated even more than you might have expected with certain use. Anyway.
I think I ran out of time.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Wu. Mr. Frankel.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Frankel, I have two questions for you to start with, one of which is my astonishment at a sentence that you wrote on page 18 of your brief, actually a paragraph, where you begin by saying, Appellee concurs with appellants that the statute is not ambiguous, and you conclude the paragraph by saying, the parties, however, disagree as to what that clear and unambiguous language means. So I'm not sure what you think the word ambiguous means. But
I guess thus the de facto inherent ambiguity. May it please the court and counsel, my name is David Frankel. I am counsel for the creditor, the appellee, Drive Financial Services, now known as Santander Consumer USA, Inc.
Excuse me, now known as what?
Santander Consumer USA, Inc. To answer the court's question, the language itself contained in the hanging paragraph of Section 1325 is clear. It is not ambiguous. It specifically states that if a vehicle is purchased less than 910 days from the date of commencement of Chapter 13 proceedings, 506A of the code does not apply.
Right, but that what we're struggling with is what does it mean to say 506 shall not apply? Because when I look at 506, it seems to me you are reading this in a way that Congress might as well have just deleted the whole thing from the statute, because all it says is that the creditor has a secured claim in the item covered by its security interest to the extent of the value of that secured claim, and it has an unsecured claim as to the rest, and that would be the same thing that would occur in non-bankruptcy situations. If these people had never filed for bankruptcy and you had foreclosed on the note in some way permitted by the note itself, you could have collected the value of the claim, and you would have then had a cause of action for the deficiency in state court. So 506 is doing exactly nothing on your reading. Maybe Congress just got in the mood to write something, or I don't know. But what's 506 doing? And when we take 506 away, have we done anything?
Section 506 was allowing the debtor to keep the asset, whereas state law allows the creditor to get the asset.
That is correct.
Part of it, you know, not 506A, though.
Section 506A, pre-BAPSIPA, was intended to provide the debtor with an opportunity.
I think we'd probably all be better off if you just said the 2005 Act.
Sure.
The acronym is not a word in the English language, to the best of my knowledge.
Very well.
Although in your defense, it is widely used in the bankruptcy community.
Well, the bankruptcy community can do in private anything it wants.
Prior to the enactment of the code in 2005, Section 506 allowed a debtor to retain collateral as property of their Chapter 13 bankruptcy estate and pay the secured creditor a bifurcated claim. With the enactment of the 2005 code, that law was changed in part to say debtors that purchased the vehicle more than 910 days from the date of commencement of the proceedings may still use Section 506A to, quote-unquote, cram down the secured creditor, whereas debtors who purchased the vehicle less than 910 days from the date of filing of the case cannot. Regardless of whether you are considering the bankruptcy code before or after the 2005 enactment of the new law, one thing has never changed, which is that if the property that serves as the basis for the creditor's security interest is not retained as part of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy estate, then Section 506 never has and doesn't now apply to that secured creditor's claim once they liquidate their collateral and become an unsecured creditor.
When you say not retained, does that mean it was surrendered or abandoned?
Surrendered.
Okay, so that's the debtor's decision then.
The debtor's decision to surrender. The debtor, both before the 2005 Act and currently, had three options. Number one, they could retain secured collateral and work out a deal with the creditor. Number two, they could cram down the secured creditor and retain the collateral. Or number three, they could surrender the collateral. The only difference with the 2005 Act is if they choose the second option to retain and cram down, they can only do so if they purchase the car more than 910 days from the date of commencement of the Chapter 13 case. The change in the Act in 2005 has no impact on a creditor's right to foreclose their security interest in their collateral, liquidate it, and if a deficiency balance then remains existing after liquidation of the collateral, to file an unsecured claim. That claim is filed.
By the way, where does 910 days come from? Is that the average length after which the security is worth more than the balance on the loan? Depreciation is front-end loaded, and the loan is a level payment loan.
Loan is a level payment loan, and the vehicle does depreciate less later in the life of a loan.
Of course.
And during that time, naturally.
So was 910 days calculated as the period during which the depreciation was likely to have made the security worth less than the loan? Is that the idea?
The legislative history and the congressional intent behind the Act, it does not specify why they said.
Nobody in Congress thought about this, surely. Right? Surely some trade association or creditors group proposed 910 days for some reason.
A very persuasive lobbying group. I believe that the purpose of the number 910 is a determination that Congress decided to put into the Act that presumes that if a vehicle is purchased less than 910 days as opposed to more than 910 days, the secured car creditor needs added protection for a variety of reasons. Number one, the loan is in the earlier stages of its life, which means the vehicle is a newer vehicle, which means it's depreciating at a faster rate.
Actually, it probably means for most car loans that it's at exactly the halfway point, because most car notes are five-year notes. I mean, people could put it on a three-year note, but they could have said 912.5 days, and that would have been exactly 2.5 years. They rounded, I suspect, so that it would be 2.5 years, but that's the halfway point of a five-year
The majority,
note.
To answer that question, Your Honor, the majority of retail installment contracts for purchases of vehicles range from 48 months to 72 months.
Four to six years.
So 5 years is a midpoint. I also believe that 910 days is the number that Congress, in their infinite wisdom, decided to use as the threshold for when there's a greater likelihood that the case may have some non-good faith elements as opposed to not have some non-good faith elements.
I doubt that.
Not going to refer us to some empirical study or anything.
There
like
is
that.
Not.
That's what I was fishing for.
There
data.
Is,
for
there
example.
Is not. There is no empirical data that I am aware of.
I'm sure there's data, but I will credit your statement that you're not aware of it.
Right.
And the
if
other
the
thing.
If the lenders don't have data on this, they're absolutely lunatics. But surely they know exactly what these numbers are.
And in your brief, you also say kind of the odd statement, when a debtor wants to surrender, the intent of the debtor is to exclude that collateral from the bankruptcy estate. And that, I think, is an infelicitous way of putting it. It's not really that debtors can say, well, I've decided to dedicate this to my bankruptcy estate and not that to my bankruptcy estate. It's all under the general umbrella of the bankruptcy estate. It's just that you, as a secured creditor, have a special right to, you know, have priority to, you know, to get whatever the collateral will bring, and the debtor can decide to do that by surrendering instead of forcing you to go through foreclosure proceedings or having it liquidated and distributed in some other way. Or
I believe that surrender of the vehicle as proposed in a Chapter 13 plan accomplishes the goal of the debtor to not have that vehicle included as part of the estate for administration of the plan by the Chapter 13
For administration
trustee.
Of the plan. In a way, it sort of keeps it carved off as an asset that the debtor is doing something with to satisfy, at least you would agree, part of the claims that are against it in the bankruptcy estate. But it's not, I mean, it's just the way you put it. It sounded like debtors got to designate what they were going to donate to the bankruptcy estate, and that really just doesn't seem to me consistent with the idea of bankruptcy.
Now, the purpose of surrender under 1325A5C is to allow a debtor to surrender collateral, secured collateral, in satisfaction of a secured portion of a claim. That's the way the law was provided before the law changed in 2005, and I believe that is still the way the law reads after 2005.
And why would a debtor ever want to do that if your opponents are wrong and there is no right to have that be full satisfaction? It seems to me the debtor should say, come and get me, since there's no cram down anymore.
The reason that a debtor would surrender an under 910 car, there's a variety of reasons. One, for example, would be the fact that if the vehicle is included in their Chapter 13 plan and they're required to make payments, you know, for the vehicle in their Chapter 13 plan, a plan would not be feasible because they wouldn't be able to afford to make the payments.
But according to you, they still have to make payments for the deficiency, right?
The creditor would be entitled to file and is entitled to file an unsecured claim for the deficiency
right.
balance owed. In a Chapter 13 case, a Chapter 13 plan can be anywhere from a 0% plan.
It can be written down as the secured claim cannot be.
Of course. And the
right.
and the unsecured creditors are paid pro rata
sure.
based on a percentage. A plan could be a 0% plan, or under certain circumstances,
yeah, right,
it could
right.
be a 100% plan payable with interest. That all depends on the facts and circumstances of any particular case. But by surrendering the collateral, the debtor minimizes the amount of quote-unquote secure debt that's in their plan for administration and thus presumably lowers their monthly Chapter 13 payments. Again, as the court correctly noted earlier, there is nothing in the law after 2005 that specifically states that a debtor who purchases a vehicle less than 910 days from the date of filing may surrender it in full satisfaction of the claim. The code is silent to that effect. And I believe Congress left the code silent to that effect because the code has always been silent to that effect. There never has been anything in the code that said that upon surrender of secured collateral, the secured creditor can liquidate their collateral and file an unsecured claim for a deficiency balance. That creditor's right has always been based on state law, and the claim can be allowed or disallowed under Section 502 of the
Code. Based on state law, what are your client's rights under state law? How does one interpret this blur?
The contract that is part of the record was attached on an electronic filing of a proof of claim. I'd be more than happy to provide the court with the
electronic filings don't do any good if what happened here is, you know, my assessment is that this was a contract on long paper. It was scanned in a way that shrunk it to legal-sized paper.
Correct.
And then it was scanned at a low setting, like about 100 dots per inch. So you're trying to shrink and scan at a low resolution, and the result is you might as well have submitted a Rorschach blot. It doesn't do what the record needs to do.
I understand
things at their correct length and scan them at high enough resolution that they can be read.
And I will so advise my client, Your Honor. I will provide the court with a legible copy of the retail installment contract so the court is aware that the contract at issue is a standard form Illinois retail installment contract. It is not a non-recourse contract. Under state law...
you say. No way for me to tell.
I understand. Under the contract and under state law, if there is a default under the contract or any other breach occurs that entitles a secured creditor under a retail installment contract for a vehicle to take possession, that creditor can liquidate its collateral under the Illinois Commercial Code and can proceed to collect on a deficiency balance. They do not lose their right to collect on a deficiency balance upon surrender, repossession, seizure.
You'd be much helped if that's what the contract actually says, but we will need to verify this for ourselves.
Absolutely. Thank you very much if there's no further questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And we asked you a lot of questions, Mr. Wu, so I'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you have anything further.
Actually, Your Honor, I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. The case